the 20th century. Part of Stravinsky's ballet music for The Rite of Spring, which famously caused a riot at its first performance. Music of the 20th century is the most difficult to understand, not only because we are so close to it, but also because the century has seen more radical change in art than at any other time in history. Serialism, neoclassicism, neo-romanticism, expressionism, minimalism, impressionism, every decade has had its new ism, its new fashion, and audiences have been left bewildered and not a little frightened. Mere mention of the names of Schoenberg and Berg, for example, is still likely to send a shudder through many concertgoers, even though one died in 1935 and the other in 1951. And yet if one knows and understands what they were trying to do, a definite pattern begins to emerge. The momentous changes in music this century didn't, of course, start in the year 1900. The seeds had been sown 35 years earlier by Richard Wagner. While writing his opera, Tristan und Isolde, first produced in 1865, Wagner had wanted to express the unfulfilled passion of Isolde, and in the third bar of the prelude used a chord which was to become known as the Tristan chord. This employs the notes F, B, D sharp, G sharp. The chord follows a short, arching phrase on the cellos, and promptly cancels out both possible destinations a listener might expect the cello line to reach. The pattern is repeated three times. Here we have the beginnings of atonality. The chord does not resolve. It is left hanging there. This is color in its own right, expressing meaning and not related to traditional keys or traditional expectations. A similar attempt to break new ground was taking place in painting. Painters had moved away from orthodox painting to use primary colours in close proximity to each other to give an impression of the object being viewed. This impressionism, as it became known, was carried into music, also by French composers, the most important of whom was Claude Debussy, who very early in his career had come under the spell of Wagner. Debussy was born at Saint-Germain-en-Laye in 1862 and died in Paris in 1918. As a student at the Paris Conservatoire, he rebelled against orthodox harmony teaching, but still managed to win the Prix de Rome at his third attempt. This took him to Rome to study at the Villa Medici, but after 2 years he was fed up and left. On his return to Paris, he spent a lot of time in the rooms of the poet Stéphane Mallarmé. These were the focal points for the young and fashionable writers, artists, and musicians of the capital, and it was here that Debussy first felt deeply about a synthesis of the arts, that music, painting, and literature could be thought of in each other's terms and language. Debussy's early musical influences included Russian music, especially Mussorgsky, the Javanese gamelan, which he heard at the 1889 exposition, and of course Wagner, although he was later to break that particular spell. Debussy's music has often been described as impressionistic, a term he disliked intensely, even though he was doing in music what the impressionist painters were doing in art. It's interesting to note that he originally intended to become a painter. Debussy believed that the mind of the composer, like that of a poet, should be aware of the unconscious. He was preoccupied with dreams. He was a man of instinct, of the senses, and although he could never quite bring himself to abandon tonality, he certainly brought harmony to a point at which it was only a step away. His distinctive harmonies were conceived in washes of sound. He employed progressions which his harmony teachers had forbidden, and unrelated chords. He made extensive use of the whole tone and pentatonic scales, and of the old church modes in his search for a new sound palette. Debussy was not a prolific composer. It took him 12 years to write his operatic masterpiece, Pelléas et Mélisande, and he had to escape to an Eastbourne hotel, following the attempted suicide of his first wife, in order to complete one of his best-known works, La Mer. The path on which Debussy had embarked was also trodden by such composers as Gabriel Fauré and Maurice Ravel. Changes to the colours of the orchestral palette were not the only changes going on. Musical activity during the 20th century has been more varied and more frenetic than at any other time in history. Whereas it is usually possible to trace direct lines, for example in the early development of opera, in the 20th century, everything was going on simultaneously. This makes it one of the most difficult periods to understand. After all, it took 300 years for polyphony to evolve from basic Gregorian chant. We now have new forms, new explorations appearing every few years, simultaneously. Much of this change came from the desire of all artists, writers, and painters, as well as musicians, to examine and confront the status quo. The world as they knew it was undergoing shattering change. Scientific advances were undermining conventional belief and altering man's perception and understanding of the universe around him. Old values were being challenged and overthrown. Politically, Europe was about to break up. The old order was changing. Why should the arts, which both reflect contemporary culture and very often lead it, not also be subject to change? While some composers examined the colour of music, others looked at another important ingredient, rhythm. Classical music employs regular patterns of rhythms, a series of accents arranged in groups of two or three or multiples of each. Occasionally, there might be irregular patterns, but once set up, they tended to be maintained with a regular pulse. There could be variations with rhythm, such as syncopation, but the main pulse had to be as regular as a metronome. The man who led the attack on this conventional rhythm was the Russian composer Igor Stravinsky. He, perhaps more than any other single composer, has left his shadow on this century, and in his own chameleon-like career, he utilized most of the major musical changes this century has seen. He did not begin as a musical rebel. He was born near St. Petersburg in 1882, the son of an operatic bass who did not want him to become a musician. Instead, he was sent to law college, where one of his fellow students was a son of Rimsky-Korsakov. And it was Rimsky who not only taught the young composer, but was to provide the first major influence on him. An early symphony and the score for the ballet The Firebird, which he wrote for Diaghilev, can only be described as continuing the Russian tradition. The Danse Infernale of King Katché from Stravinsky's ballet The Firebird. While it was written in 1910, there are already signs of Stravinsky's interest in Debussy and the French Impressionists, and his preoccupation with rhythm. When his ballet score, The Rite of Spring, was first performed in 1913 in Paris, it caused a famous riot. Its orgiastic violence shocked the audience, which did not understand what Stravinsky was trying to do. the Rite of Spring largely ignored conventional harmony, form, and above all, rhythm. The strong beats are still there, but not in any regular pattern. The music changes time signature frequently, sometimes even within the same bar. Sometimes different parts have different time signatures set against each other. This enabled Stravinsky to create an atmosphere of enormous emotion, intensity, and animal strength. The dynamic range, the rhythmic complexity, the harmonic brilliance, and the orchestral coloring of the Rite of Spring have rarely been rivaled. It remains a touchstone work, against which most composers who followed have had to measure themselves. Problems of rhythm were to occupy Stravinsky for many years after the Rite of Spring, even when he entered his neoclassical phase. In 1920, he had settled in France and became more incorporating jazz and popular music into his own. He then entered a neoclassical phase, looking back to the music of Mozart by striving for the virtues of form, balance, and clarity. His opera, The Rake's Progress, premiered in Venice in 1951, was thought by many to be simply a pastiche of Mozart. A close examination of the score shows it to be unmistakably Stravinsky, with its obsession on rhythmic variety and complexity. It is Mozart filtered through 20th century ears. It was only after reading reviews for The Rake, which said in effect that he was no longer the great innovator, and that title belonged to Schoenberg, his great rival, that Stravinsky first used atonalism. He was nearly 70. Atonalism is sometimes known as the 12-tone system, or serialism. It was first defined as a compositional technique by the Austrian composer Arnold Schoenberg. Schoenberg was born in Vienna in 1874 and was largely self-taught. His early music was strongly romantic, tonal, and heavily influenced by Wagner. But he was friendly with a number of expressionist painters, and like them, he too wanted to find a simplicity of form that would heighten the emotional impact of his music. Like Debussy, he came to realize that Wagner had opened up a new world of possibilities, that the old musical order, like the old social orders, had been undermined, and something new was required to take its place. Unlike Debussy, who did not propound theories, Schoenberg felt he needed a theory to explain logically what he was trying to do instinctively. He did not, however, formulate his theories until some 10 years after he first started to put them into practice. The situation in which Schoenberg found himself was this. Music had previously been dominated by the tonic, the note that gives us the key, and the dominant, or fifth. Any move away from those notes, or into a different key, required a resolution, a return to the tonic or dominant, before the piece could finish. Such tonal music is based on minor and major scales. Schoenberg decided to base his new musical language on all 12 notes of the chromatic scale, the 12-tone row, as it's sometimes called. But, and this is the great difference with what had gone before, each note of the chromatic scale had to be of equal importance. Other composers, such as Debussy, had used chromatic scales and scales other than major and minor, but because certain notes appeared more often than others, they somehow assumed leadership and became a tonic. Atonality, a term Schoenberg actually disliked, he preferred pantonality, uses all 12 notes of the chromatic scale placed in any order or permutation. Thus, the basic chromatic scale might become Once decided on, this sequence does not have to stay in the same octave. The notes can jump around the octaves, but no note can be repeated until all 12 have been heard in some form or other, either as part of the melody or as part of a chord. When it comes to composing with this tone row, as it became called, the composer had to impose a rhythmic structure on it. This could be simply the length of the notes, creating a phrase, or the row could be turned upside down, used back to front, turned upside down and back to front at the same time, transposed, or have anything done to it the composers had always done to a musical line to create variety and texture. The important thing was always that the notes should maintain their relationship. Inevitably, this formula meant that in the early days of serialism, composers, determined not to be thought in any sense tonal, made sure they avoided chords which might be instantly recognizable. They also stuck religiously to their tone rows. But as they became more practiced, they were able to produce music that has a lushness akin to tonal music. As well as devising the system of atonalism, Schoenberg taught it to a number of other major composers. Some, such as Roberto Gerhardt, the Spanish composer who later settled in Britain, took only aspects of Schoenberg's teaching into their own music. But two who developed it even further were Anton Webern and Alban Berg. And when towards the end of his life Schoenberg ended up teaching in California, his ideas were passed on to a new generation of American musicians. Few composers since Schoenberg, even resolutely tonal composers, have remained untouched by him. The French composer, Olivier Messiaen, himself a noted teacher, was one of the first converts to atonalism, but he moulded the theory to his own uses. A committed Catholic, he was a religious mystic who had highly personal theories on composition. He drew heavily on Oriental music, exploring the different sound worlds gained by having tuned percussion. He used Gregorian chant and birdsong, and helped move serialism towards the mainstream by giving his scores consonants and repetitive rhythm. Première communion de la Vierge, the 11th regard, from Messiaen's 20 regards sur l'enfant Jésus. Just as Debussy had attempted to put into music the ideas of the Impressionist painters, so composers such as Schoenberg, Alban Berg, in his operas Lulu and Wozzeck, and Richard Strauss, attempted to incorporate the ideas of the Expressionist movement into their work. Expressionist artists were looking for simplified ways of expressing emotion, often by distorting line and colour. They were fascinated by the new discovery of psychoanalysis, and in particular the theories of another Austrian, Sigmund Freud. Translated into music, usually though not always written for the... This meant dissonance, angular melodies, and broken rhythms. Strauss, like most composers, cannot be given just one label throughout a career that in his case lasted well over 60 years, but two of his major operas, Salome and Elektra, were written as expressionist pieces. Strauss was born in Munich in 1864, the son of a horn player in the Munich opera. While composing all the time, he published his first composition, an orchestral march, when he was only 12, he became an operatic conductor, appearing at Munich and Bayreuth before having Guntram, his first opera, and clearly modelled on Wagner, produced in 1894. He later became musical director of the Berlin Opera, but his early fame as a composer rested on such vividly scored, audaciously written tone poems as Don Juan, Till Eulenspiegel, and Don Quixote. In 1905, Strauss's opera Salome caused a sensation, and was promptly banned as obscene. The music is unashamedly erotic, with brilliant orchestral writing, but it was considered too strong for the stage. His next piece, Electra, produced in 1909, matched the blood-curdling cruelty of the Greek legend with harsh dissonances and was considered both brutal and anti-vocal. Many people saw the music as being an accurate representation of the political disintegration then happening in Europe. After those two powerful works, Strauss surprised everyone by returning to 18th-century Vienna for his next opera, Der Rosenkavalier. First produced in 1911, it is a homage to Mozart. His writing is more lyrical and neoclassical. With its abundance of melodies, especially the famous waltz for Baron Ochs, its sumptuous scoring, full of emotion, grace, and style, this has remained one of the best-loved operas of all time. A composer who was much influenced by the way Strauss used the orchestra was Gustav Holst. His most famous work, the orchestral suite, The Planets, uses equally large forces in a vivid way. It was written in response to Holst's interest in mysticism and astrology, and is deservedly popular. Holst was always very much an individual. An Englishman of Swedish descent, he was born in Cheltenham in 1874. And died in London in 1934. While playing the trombone in the Carl Rosa Orchestra, he learnt Sanskrit so that he could study Eastern poetry and philosophy. This interest produced his early hymns from the Rig Veda and the chamber opera Savitri. Later interests which found their way into his music included Gnosticism. Holst was particularly fascinated by the problems of rhythm, and his early compositions are noted for their irregular rhythms and angular approach. He later changed to a more neoclassical, polyphonic style as a way of obtaining greater clarity of thought, a move that anticipated the way Stravinsky would also go. Here is Jupiter, the bringer of jollity from the Planet Suite, from which the hymn tune, I Vow to Thee My Country, was taken. Many leading composers of the 20th century deliberately avoided the past, it would be wrong to think that avant-garde music was the only important music being written, that anyone not a disciple of Schoenberg, Debussy, or Stravinsky was by definition second-rate. Strauss, as we've just heard, together with Gustav Mahler, brought the Romantic movement into the 20th century, and the symphony, a form considered by some to be archaic, reached a height from which many think it can go no further. A key figure in this neo-romantic movement was the English composer Edward Elgar, and it's no coincidence that his music was often better received in Germany than it was in Britain. Elgar was a son of a music seller. He was born near Worcester in 1857 and received little formal musical education, playing the violin in amateur orchestras, the organ in the local Roman Catholic Church, and becoming bandmaster at the local mental home. His early compositions were for his local groups, but encouraged by his wife, he began to turn to larger scale works. His overture of Froissart, played at the Three Choirs Festival when he was 33, led to a number of other commissions before he became well known in 1899 with his variations on an original theme, better known as the Enigma variations. He was 42. Nimrod, from the Enigma Variations. A year later, Elgar wrote his marvellous oratorio, The Dream of Gerontius. Other oratorios followed, together with two powerful symphonies, the Violin Concerto and his final great work, the Cello Concerto. Elgar's music is quintessentially of its period, and the Cello Concerto contains all the longing for a past that had all but disappeared as a result of the First World War. It comes as little surprise that after writing it, despite living a further dozen years, he died in 1934, he felt emotionally drained and unable to write again. This is how it opens. During the 19th century, the symphony had been an almost exclusive Austro-German form. During the 20th century, its greatest practitioners came from other parts of Europe, two of them from Scandinavia. Jean Sibelius is the best-known and probably greatest composer Finland has ever produced. He wrote seven symphonies and possibly an eighth, which he burnt. For him, the symphony was a lifelong obsession. It meant much more to him than pure form. He once described them as confessions of faith from different periods of my life. It's as if God the Father had thrown down the tiles of a mosaic from heaven's floor and asked me to determine what kind of picture it was. Sibelius was born in 1865 and became a composer after initially studying law. 4 years after completing his musical education in Vienna, he was given a government grant to allow him to compose. He became a folk hero for his music, which seemed to many to sum up all that was best in the Finnish character and landscape. His orchestral work, The Swan of Tuonela, came out of a proposed opera based on ancient Finnish epics. Inexperienced at the time, he was 30, he gave up the idea of an opera and wrote instead a four-part cycle based on the same legends. The piece made the composer's name at home and abroad. Although Sibelius wrote popular orchestral pieces, such as Finlandia and the Karelia Suite, together with a much-performed violin concerto and some delightful songs, his reputation now rests largely on his symphonies. These are very diverse in character, but all show the same individual treatment of the orchestra and method of construction. Short motifs, which are repeated and do not really come together until much later on. He was a master of mood changes, summoning up spine-tingling outbursts of sound. During his last 30 years, he died aged 91, Sibelius wrote nothing. The world was awaiting his eighth symphony, but it never appeared. Here is part of the third and final movement of his fifth symphony, a work he significantly revised after its first performance in 1915 on the day of the composer's 50th birthday. Sibelius has had a profound effect on many symphonists who followed him. American composers such as Roy Harris, Aaron Copland, and William Schumann, British composers such as Malcolm Arnold, Peter Maxwell Davis, and William Walton, and many others are among those whose own symphonies contain echoes of the formal thinking and very special sound world that Sibelius conjured up. The most significant British symphonist of this time was Ralph Vaughan Williams. An avid collector of folk songs, Vaughan Williams' most significant orchestral works were not written until he was well into his 60s. Of his 9 symphonies, numbers 4, 5, and 6 in particular are works of vision and power. Witness the opening of number 6. If the symphony has refused to lie down and die in the 20th century, so too has that other quintessentially romantic form, the concerto. Following firmly in the line of virtuoso composers of the last century was the Russian Sergei Rachmaninoff. He was one of the world's great pianists, with a handspan of an octave and 5 notes, and one of his greatest pleasures was to sit for hours at the piano and improvise. Improvisation played an important part in his music, but so too did melody, even when other composers around him were eschewing it. "How can I compose without melody?" he once asked. Rachmaninoff was born in Russia in 1873, began to learn the piano at the age of 4, and eventually graduated with a gold medal in composition from the Moscow Conservatoire. He knew Tchaikovsky, who became a father figure to him, and one can hear the influence in his music. The first movement of Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto, written at the turn of the century and first performed in Moscow with the composer as soloist. It wasn't just audiences who were having difficulty in coming to terms with the new music. Composers such as Rachmaninoff also felt uncomfortable with what was happening around them. "I feel like a ghost, wandering in a world grown alien," he once said. "I cannot cast out the old way of writing, and I cannot acquire the new." Sometime it seemed that the Russian romantic tradition represented by Rachmaninoff was at an end. With the advent of Stalinist rule, composers were expected to toe the party line. Party officials understood the power of music to move people and wanted that power harnessed for the state, not against it. The West did not believe that any composer working under such conditions could produce music of any integrity. Nor did the Soviet system allow for much in the way of experimentation. So for a long time, the music of Dmitri Shostakovich was dismissed as being little more than party-approved banality. We know better now. not only of Shostakovich's personal struggle to undermine the Soviet regime in his music, but of the power and grandeur of most of his output. His Tenth Symphony, for example, written in 1953 after the death of Stalin and the composer's own bitter celebration of the event, is acknowledged to be one of the greatest symphonies of all time. Shostakovich was born in St. Petersburg in 1906 and died in Moscow almost 70 years later. He wrote his first symphony while still a 19-year-old student at the Leningrad Conservatoire and was immediately hailed as a shining example of the brilliant musicians the new Soviet system could turn out. Despite being the darling of the authorities, Shostakovich fell out with them in 1936 when his opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, was denounced as being brutal and degrading. He promptly withdrew his Fourth Symphony, and when his Fifth appeared, it was subtitled An Artist's Reply to Just Criticism. To escape the wrath of the authorities, Shostakovich withdrew more and more into a private world of chamber music, and his 15 string quartets are among the most important contributions to the genre this century. His later works include the enormously impressive Leningrad Symphony, written at the height of the Second World War, his violin and cello concertos, and his last symphonies. Shostakovich is now recognized as being one of the great figures in the Russian musical tradition. His Eighth String Quartet was written in 1960, following a visit to Dresden. The city had been devastated during the Second World War by Allied bombers at the request of Russia. Shostakovich was horrified by what he saw, and dedicated his quartet to the memory of all war victims. Here is the opening movement. Another major figure to emerge from Russia this century was Sergei Prokofiev. Born in 1891, he was 15 years Shostakovich's senior. While Shostakovich brought out the despair of living under an oppressive regime, Prokofiev was the master of melody. A child prodigy, writing a three-act opera when he was only nine, he was briefly in the class of Rimsky-Korsakov, who had taught so many of Russia's composers and given lessons also to Stravinsky. Prokofiev was also an outstanding pianist. One of his earliest successes was his first piano concerto. It may have won him a prize, but its angular rhythms and percussive nature upset some people, including the establishment. His most appealing early works are his third piano concerto and the famous Classical Symphony, written as a homage to Haydn. In 1918, following the revolution, Prokofiev left Russia for the United States, then moved to Paris, and finally back to the USSR in 1934, where his music became much more acceptable to the state. His scores after his return home include the ballet Romeo and Juliet, the ever-popular children's tale Peter and the Wolf, a number of fine film scores, the Fifth and Sixth Symphonies, and the opera War and Peace. After the First World War ended in 1918, the old order had gone forever. New countries were born, and the map of Europe redrawn. Just as the politicians had to find a new way forward, so too did composers. A new aesthetic was needed for the new world that was going to rise from the graves of the millions who had been slaughtered. That aesthetic, for some, was to be found by going back to roots, and not just the roots of folk and traditional music, important though they were, but the music of the dance hall, of cafes and streets, the music of popular culture, the music of jazz. In France, a group known as Les Six set about finding a voice that would be distinctly French, even though one of them was Swiss. The Six were the Swiss composer Arthur Honegger, Darius Milhaud, Georges Auric, Louis Duret, Francis Poulenc, and Germain Taillefer. Although the group did not last long, and they soon went their separate ways, their reasons for getting together in the first place never deserted them, and was to have a profound effect upon the music of Francis Poulenc in particular. Poulenc, born in Paris in 1899, was a disciple of Erik Satie, and opposed to the Romantic. He wrote ballets, orchestral works, chamber music, much piano music, songs, and stage works. In spite of composing some deeply felt religious music, he never lost his elegant wit nor love of everyday poetry. Poulenc's music evokes the smells of Paris, of France. His Sonata for Violin and Piano was written in 1943. Just as Poulenc is unmistakably French, and Rachmaninoff, Shostakovich, and Prokofiev unmistakably Russian, so Vaughan Williams is unmistakably English. The nationalistic feelings that had surfaced during the Romantic period continued into the 20th century. More and more composers began to use consciously the music of their heritage. Memories of places and of the past were important influences on many major composers. It wasn't just the earnest musicologists travelling the countryside to record a vanishing way of life who were attracted to the folk music heritage. In Britain, composers such as Percy Grainger, E.J. Moran, and Vaughan Williams went around the pubs collecting folk songs, which later became source material for larger works. In Poland, which disappeared behind the Iron Curtain, composers such as Witold Lutosławski, Karol Szymanowski, Krzysztof Penderecki, and Andrzej Panufnik, who later sought asylum in England, kept the flag of Polish nationalism alive. Szymanowski was born in 1882 in the Ukraine, the son of a Polish landowner. As a young composer, he travelled extensively in Europe, meeting other composers, including Stravinsky, and absorbing the influences he found. He spent the first years of the First World War in isolation in the Ukraine, and it was there that he wrote his Third Symphony, using poems by a 13th century Persian mystic. He finished the work, subtitled Song of the Night, in 1916. In Hungary, the leaders of nationalistic music were Zoltán Kodály, best known for his Harry János suite from a comic opera he wrote in 1926, and Béla Bartók. Béla Bartók has come to symbolize the music of Hungary this century. He was born in 1881 in a little town which is now part of Romania, and it was the music of that area that was to remain a constant source of inspiration to him throughout his life. He died in New York, where he was one of the hundreds of European artists and intellectuals trying to escape the war, in 1945, largely unknown to the general public. If people did have an opinion on his music, it was, as Time magazine's obituarist wrote, piquant, sometimes cacophonous orchestral and chamber music. As a young man, Bartok, like his contemporary and friend Kodály, was determined to found a national style. Attracted to Strauss's tone poem Also Sprach Zarathustra, at a time when it was horrifying the establishment, Bartok was warned by his teachers to keep away from musical controversy, and so he began to collect folk tunes. For consumption at home, he wrote cheerful arrangements of these tunes, while outside Hungary he became increasingly well known as a radical modernist with a bent towards abstraction. At the same time as Schoenberg was propounding his 12-tone theories, Bartok was trying to devise a system of musical proportions equivalent to those found in the architecture of Le Corbusier. This involved classical proportions based on the golden mean, derived from the Greeks, and meant there had, in the ideal scale, to be certain intervals and ratios between notes. Bartok also took the virtuoso concerto to its logical conclusion by writing a concerto for that most virtuoso of instruments, the orchestra itself. The genre was developed because of an American need to show off the increased technical abilities of their orchestras, and other composers who have written them include Michael Tippett, Lutosławski, Swarovski, Paul Hindemith, Elliot Carter, and Roger Sessions. Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra was commissioned by Koussevitzky for the Boston Symphony Orchestra and first performed in 1944. Czech composer Bohuslav Martimov, who was born and lived his early life at the top of a church tower, but then lived in Paris and the United States, never forgot his roots. As much as he sought to develop his own idiom, his music remained deeply rooted in the folk songs and memories of childhood. Another Czech composer inextricably bound up with his native land was Leoš Janáček. He was born in Moravia, in what was then part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire in 1854, and died there in 1918. Janáček has only been regarded as a major composer since his death. He worked in relative obscurity in Brno as a teacher, composer, and collector of folk songs. He developed theories based on his studies of sounds from nature and peasant speech, which he incorporated in his compositions, most notably in his opera The Cunning Little Vixen. Most of Janáček's life was spent in compositional obscurity. It was not until he was in his 60s that his opera Yenufa brought him international acclaim and led to a period of sustained creativity which produced most of his acknowledged masterpieces. He wrote orchestral music and chamber works and a series of operatic masterworks, Yenufa, Katya Kabanova, The Cunning Little Vixen, and the Makropoulos case amongst them. Here he used the orchestra not simply to support the voice, to comment upon the action on stage or to provide moods, all the ways the orchestra had traditionally been used, but as a voice in its own right, of equal importance with the human voice. Janáček is one of the most significant operatic composers of the century. Although only 13 years younger than Dvořák, whom he knew, he belongs firmly in this century. He founded no school, and few have attempted to imitate him. A synthesis of romanticism with nationalistic elements is unique. Here is the opening of his last orchestral work, the Sinfonietta. A similar story can be found in the United States. For many years, North American culture had been European-dominated. Composers and artists, even if they did not end up studying in Europe, which most of them did, were taught by people who were firmly in the European tradition. One of the earliest pioneers of an American voice in music was Charles Ives, who lived from 1874 until 1954. His writing had its base in Romanticism, but was overlaid with a very individual, eclectic, and experimental character. The hostility that greeted his early compositions caused him to keep his work to himself and become an insurance salesman instead. By the time he was 40, he was running his own business and was a very rich man, but hardly any of his music had been heard in public. In 1930 he retired, but he had also stopped composing, and it was only afterwards that his music began to be played and its significance realized. Another important figure in the history of American music was Aaron Copland. Like George Gershwin with Porgy and Bess, the Piano Concerto and Rhapsody in Blue, Copland was one of the first to create music influenced by the sounds of America. Jazz, hymn tunes, folk songs, cowboy music, ragtime, Charleston. Born in 1910, the son of Russian Jewish immigrants, he grew up in Brooklyn. There was no music in the family, and no obvious reason why he should have decided by the age of 16 to become a composer. But, as a child, he loved French music. Debussy, he said, was hot stuff. It was hardly surprising that he went eventually to Paris to study. There he came under the spell of Nadia Boulanger, a legendary teacher, who was also a composer in her own right. After 3 years with Boulanger, during which time he got to know the work of Stravinsky and Lesis, Copland returned to America. Even though today many of his early pieces sound simply jazzy, and others only really flirt with serialism, both public and critics found Copland's music totally inaccessible. He was dismissed with such comments as, "If he can write a symphony like that at the age of 23, in 5 years' time he'll be ready to commit murder." It wasn't long before Copland decided to change his style, and became passionate about writing for a wider audience. The result was that by the 1950s, no Hollywood Western was complete without a score that nodded in the direction of his ballets, Billy the Kid, and Rodeo, and no patriotic occasion was possible without a version of Fanfare for the Common Man. Part of Copland's ballet score for Billy the Kid. Not all his later music was so easy to listen to first time around. His piano quartet of 1951 continued to employ serialist techniques, and others of his works are distinctly modern. But what Copland did, by using simple but effective orchestration, exciting rhythmic variations, folk tunes, and a style instantly recognizable as his own, was to show the American public and other American musicians that America could have a popular musical language that was its own. Samuel Barber, who lived from 1910 until 1981, wrote in the European tradition, but with an unmistakably American feel, as did Roy Harris. Even Americans who adopted serialism, such as Roger Sessions, who studied with Schoenberg in California, or Elliot Carter, contained something uniquely American about the way they handle their material. In other parts of the world as well, the Western classical tradition was being taken and moulded for local consumption. Heitor Villa-Lobos was born in Rio de Janeiro in 1887 and died there in 1959. His father was an amateur musician and librarian. The turn of the century was a time of enormous change in Brazil. Slavery, the staple of the Brazilian economy for so long, was abolished the year after Villa-Lobos was born, and the Brazilian Republic was founded soon afterwards. Villa-Lobos's association with Rio's street musicians, his work as a cellist in theatre orchestras, and his exploration of the Brazilian jungles were to be important influences upon him as he attempted to fuse the European tradition with native Brazilian material. Here is El Chinesito. Spain began to produce its own musical voice this century. Manuel de Falla's Nights in the Garden of Spain is his evocation of the gardens of the Alhambra Palace in Granada. Granados and Albéniz also worked in a distinctly Spanish idiom, as did Joaquín Rodrigo. Born in 1901 and blind from the age of three, Rodrigo has written much more than his famous guitar concerto. But it is this work which is not only one of the world's favorite pieces of music, but seems to sum up Spain itself for many people. It also helped to make the guitar a respectable instrument for the concert platform. Today, Western composers not only utilize their own heritage, they scour the world for sights and sounds they can incorporate in their music. A significant number of British composers are heavily involved with Indian classical forms. Others are attracted to folk music from parts of the world not usually associated with Western classical music, such as South Africa. There has always been a European fascination with the Far East and Japan. The Impressionists in France were heavily influenced by Japanese art, and both Gilbert and Sullivan's The Mikado and Puccini's Madame Butterfly sparked off an interest in Japanese music. Now the roles have been reversed, and Japanese composers have begun to explore Western forms from their own perspective. The most distinguished is Toru Takemitsu, who was born in 1930 and died in 1996. He has bridged East and West in a way unthinkable 50 years ago. Takemitsu's music is very easy on the ear, but not all experiments in the 20th century have been so straightforward. Some composers set out deliberately to set themselves apart from audiences by writing music which took no account of the listener. It became very complex, dense, and almost impenetrable, so that whereas once the new was the novelty everyone wanted, last year's piece became preferable to this year's. A gulf grew between much contemporary music and ordinary people. Among the ideas that some composers jettisoned was that music needed some sort of unifying form. The classical sonata form of ABA was no longer considered necessary. Indeed, it was no longer thought necessary even to have a bridge or transition between musical ideas. Symphonies were written as single movements. Rules could and should be broken. Ideas from previous generations were out of the window. In this attitude, composers were reflecting one of the most important cultural influences of the century, the cinema. Film could cut from one image to the next, backwards or forwards in time, without having detailed explanation. Film composers had to adapt their technique to suit these requirements, producing short bursts of time-specific and often emotion-specific music. Some of the biggest names wrote music for films, starting with Saint-Saëns in the silent days. Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Britten, Malcolm Arnold, William Walton, Arthur Bliss, Vaughan Williams, Erich Korngold, Jacques Ibert, Elizabeth Lutyens, and her pupil Richard Rodney Bennett, all have written compelling film scores very much in their own style. As well as finding new ways to shape music, Composers wanted to find ways to produce new sounds. At one end of the scale, that meant writing a concerto for a vacuum cleaner or a snowmobile. At the other, it could mean the multimedia work of composers like John Cage, incorporating live music with taped music. Cage, who lived from 1912 until 1992, revolutionized many aspects of music making, in particular the relationship between the performer and the listener, between the work and the place in which it was being performed. For performances of Roratorio, written in 1979, the audience was invited to wander around a concert hall while Irish musicians played in one space, readings from Joyce were heard in another, and a tape composition was playing in a third. Cage took listening to its extreme in 1952, when a pianist walked out onto the platform, sat at the piano for precisely 4 minutes, 33 seconds, and then left. Was it a joke? Was it a comment on critics? Was it a good performance? Cage has only said that he had scored the piece for an orchestra as well. It was almost certainly his comment on the distractions of watching musicians play while trying to listen to the music, and that all sound is important, even silence. Electronic music has played an increasingly important role in classical music this century. One of the pioneers of electronic music was Edgar Varèse, who inspired composers and musicians from Pierre Boulez and Karlheinz Stockhausen to Charlie Parker and Frank Zappa. Varèse, who died in 1965, was born in Villars, in the Burgundy region of France, in 1883, but spent much of his adult life in a self-imposed exile in America. He was a difficult, combative, flamboyant man who suffered from severe bouts of depression. He left Europe in 1916, and whenever he came back, it was with very mixed feelings and to a very mixed reception. He wrote very little, no more than a dozen or so pieces, although he did burn all his early works, including one that had been given a first performance in Berlin by Stokowski before the First World War. And for an interval of 12 years, he wrote nothing before producing in 1954 one of his major works, Désert. Varèse set out to create a new musical language that would mirror what was happening in other arts, and be specifically for the 20th century. He was concerned with sound, as sound in its own little moment of time. He was interested in sound textures, in using sound rather as colours. He was more interested in exploring the nature of sound and reinventing music than continuing with tradition. In the visual arts and the theatre, as well as in music, traditional forms were being deconstructed. In painting, there was a move towards abstraction. Abstraction may not have become the mainstream of art, but figurative painting today cannot but acknowledge what happened in abstract art. And similarly, the music of Varèse has had an influence on those who have come after him, even if only indirectly. Among those attracted to electronic music and the new sounds were five men born during the 1920s. German composer Karlheinz Stockhausen, a pupil of Messiaen, Yanis Xenakis, Luciano Berio, Georges Ligeti, and Pierre Boulez. All were to prove especially influential on the younger generation, either as a result of their work or as teachers. Frenchman Pierre Boulez extended the methods of 12-tone technique to organizing constituent parts of music, such as rhythms and volume, into mathematical formulae. He is also interested in the spatial relationships of sound, and has been particularly influential as a result of IACAM, the Center for Musical Acoustical Research and Electronic Music he set up in Paris in 1977. His piano sonatas occupy an important position in the piano literature of the 20th century. The second sonata was written in 1948, 2 years after the first. It is in four movements, three fast, one slow. Here is part of the opening fast movement. Other composers were attracted by the mathematical possibilities of writing scores which could be passed through a machine, since mere mortal musicians found them difficult, if not impossible, to play, particularly when quarter notes were being used. Some composers even went so far as to write everything to a self-devised formula, which made Schoenberg's serialism seem the height of simplicity and melodic inspiration. Much of this new music became very hard to understand, or even appreciate. The gulf between the composer and the listener had never been greater. Naturally, the pendulum began to swing again. As a reaction against many of the blind alleys of musical exploration, some composers sought a return to tonality. But after all that had gone before, it could hardly be a return to the old ways. Composers, as artists, want to continue to explore and develop. One way the new generation found was in the simplicity and shifting patterns of what became known as minimalist music, the repeating of melodic phrases or patterns. Early pioneers of this kind of music were the Americans Philip Glass and Steve Reich, both born in 1936. That was a passage from Steve Reich's New York Counterpoint for 11 clarinets. This kind of systems music was taken up by John Adams, the most frequently performed living American composer. The repetition, which is at the base of minimalism, allows the composer to create harmonic structures which constantly drive forward, change color, and change emphasis. One of the best known of current European minimalists is the Polish composer Henryk Górecki, whose Third Symphony became the first classical composition by a living composer ever to make it to the top 10 in the pop album charts. The death of the symphony has often been hailed during the 20th century, but far from being dead, it's been alive and well, and in the hands of such composers as Hans Werner Henze and Peter Maxwell Davis, it's actually flourishing. One composer who was always determined to write symphonies was Michael Tippett. He was born in London in 1905, and from an early age was a rebel. His mother was a suffragette, and he clearly inherited her spirit of rebellion, having to change schools, and eventually being imprisoned himself for failing to do war work. Tippett is a composer very concerned with ideas. His works explore such themes as the nature of time, human creativity, and the social significance of art, in which the underlying emphasis is always on coming to know oneself. Tippett has written symphonies, chamber works, concertos, oratorios, and a number of highly acclaimed operas, for which he wrote his own librettos. These include King Priam, The Midsummer Marriage, and The Knot Garden, all are written in a spare, highly individual style which demands work by the listener. But they more than reward any time spent with them. The ritual dances from The Midsummer Marriage. Tippett's great contemporary was Benjamin Britten, one of the most significant of British 20th century composers. Britten was 8 years younger than Tippett and began writing music as a child, with lessons from the composer Frank Bridge. Before the war, he wrote music for documentary films and radio plays. His spare but lyrical scoring made his music perfect for creating atmosphere. And he later went on to write a number of important orchestral pieces, such as The Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra and a violin concerto. But it was always the human voice that fascinated him most, partly, no doubt, because his lifelong partner, Peter Peers, was a tenor. Peers was to become the leading interpreter of Britten's vocal music, and many of Britten's leading operatic roles were written for him. It was as an operatic composer that Britten made his most significant contribution. Peter Grimes, commissioned by the Koussevitzky Foundation and given its first American production at Tanglewood, conducted by a young Leonard Bernstein, was first produced at Sadler's Wells in 1945, when the company returned to their London home after spending the war years out on the road. Despite complaints from the chorus that it was impossible to sing and the resignation of one of the principals who considered the music to be rubbish, Grimes, with Peers in the title role, was an enormous success and established a new era in English opera. It was the first opera by an Englishman to gain a regular place in the international repertory since Purcell's Dido and Aeneas some 300 years earlier. Britten went on to write further operas, among them The Rape of Lucretia, Albert Herring, Billy Budd, Gloriana, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Owen Wingrave, and Death in Venice. He also, following a visit to Japan, became fascinated by no plays, and with his church parable, Curlew River, based on a Japanese story about a madwoman searching for her lost child, transferred to a sort of Japanese-ish Suffolk, established a new form of music theatre. Most of Britten's music was written to be performed by his own company, the English Opera Group, at the annual festival he founded in his hometown of Aldborough. His War Requiem was written for the reconsecration of the new Coventry Cathedral, bombed during the war, and was first performed there on the 30th of May, 1962. This mixes the liturgical text of the Requiem Mass with poems by war poet Wilfred Owen. Here is part of the Dies Irae. At the close of the 20th century, there is no more one mainstream of classical music than there was at the beginning. Music is like a tapestry made up of many coloured strands. On their own, some of these strands may look quite insignificant, but when viewed as part of the overall texture, there can be no doubt their presence helps make today's classical music as lively, varied, and as vibrant as it has possibly ever been. The Polish composer Lutosławski thought that orchestral composition, as we understand it, would die out with the invention of new especially electronic instruments. So far, there's no sign of that happening. The new is being absorbed into the old. Financial considerations throughout the world have meant a drastic scaling down in the forces employed for music being written now. Few composers can write a piece for 200 instruments and an equal number of voices and hope to see it performed. Smaller scale ensembles are more usually the order of the day, but there are still operas being written and being produced. More important for the future of music is that composers, while remaining aware of the experimentation of the immediate past, are rejecting the totally cerebral approach and are once again wanting to communicate with audiences. Contemporary music is as lively and inventive as it has been through the ages. New voices are continually emerging to challenge the old. Most make no secret of the fact that they want people to listen to their music, that if they do not relate to the audience and the audience to them, then they have, in a sense, failed. That does not mean contemporary music has to be bland or boring. Much of it remains challenging and requires considerable work on behalf of the listener. But after a century of change and turmoil, it seems we now stand on the threshold of a new age, when the contemporary composer could once again be in the mainstream of popular taste. Yet, having started this journey with Gregorian chant, it seems appropriate to conclude with a world that perhaps would not sound so unfamiliar with the devout of the Dark Ages. Arvo Pärt, the Estonian composer born in 1935, has his roots in chant, yet his minimalism is a distinctly 20th century voice. The spiritual qualities, the spiritual message of the Western musical tradition is undimmed, even into the 21st century. Arvo Pärt's Cantus Firmus, in memory of Benjamin Britten. Audible.